Mr. Kelly, good morning.
Thank you, Judge Henderson, and may it please the court. The bank does not challenge the district court's finding below based on the undisputed evidence presented by us that the $3.4 billion Air India loan guarantees at issue here will have potentially serious adverse consequences for U.S. airlines and their employees. Instead, the bank claims that it can categorically ignore those harms under its economic impact procedures because aircraft sales do not result in the production of an exportable good. But the bank makes no attempt to reconcile its economic impact procedures with the language of the statute, and for good reason. Section 635B1B requires the bank to, quote, take into account any serious effect of its guarantees on the competitive position of U.S. industry.
A2 and E1 talk about goods and commodities, right? So it seems to me that one of the central issues that I need to resolve is, do you read those three provisions together, or does B1B stand on its own? I mean, the bank has clearly read them together. Why shouldn't they do that? Why isn't this statute about goods and commodities and not about service?
Well, first of all, I'll take issue with your point regarding the specific statutory language of the other provisions. Second of all, you cannot, it is well established, you cannot import a limitation from one provision into another provision that does not have that limitation. And it is clear that 635B1B is not limited to goods or commodities. Furthermore, the bank itself has never adopted that interpretation. If you look at page 47 to 48 of their brief, the bank describes, it does describe all three statutory provisions alike, but what it says is that they impose a balancing test. And what the bank has to do is it has to weigh the potential benefits of the loan guarantees against the competing benefits and injury that may result. It does not limit that statement to exportable goods, nor can it sensibly do so under the statute. And if you look at the only internal legal analysis that the bank has ever done, which is back in 1979, it's at page 1138 of the joint appendix. This is the only time they've actually looked at the statutory language. And what they said is that the statutory provisions, which they did read together, require in every instance, and I'll quote, that the bank must establish formal procedures that will enable it to take into account any serious adverse effects upon the U.S. economy of any export to be assisted by the Ex-Im Bank loan. And they adopted economic impact procedures back then in 1979, and they required an economic analysis of every single transaction. A team was assigned. They did a written analysis for presentation to the bank board, and the bank board made its decision based on that. Now, sometime after that, in 2001, they changed their economic impact procedures. They adopted the exportable goods screen, but there is not a word of explanation of how that exportable goods screen is consistent with their prior interpretation of the statute or with the language of the various statutory provisions. The bank doesn't even make an effort in their brief in this court to do that. They don't even defend the district court's statutory hooks analysis, which was the basis for the court's decision. But let me turn to the specific.
You acknowledge that the bank can adopt categorical rules in some instances.
Absolutely. But it is well established.
How is that going to play out then applying a statute like this? What's your vision of how this looks going forward under your view?
There's no question that they can adopt categorical rules. But this court and other courts have repeatedly said that the categorical rules cannot be a rewriting of the statute. They have to be consistent with the statutory language. So they could, for example, say all transactions under $10 million are de minimis. They're not going to cause an effect, and therefore we're not going to worry about those. They could, for example, they give these examples in their brief, say that building a power plant in a foreign country or providing a locomotive for domestic use is not going to create problems for U.S. industry. Frankly, narrow-body planes, unless they're to Mexico or Canada, don't have an effect because they're not flying to and from the United States. But here we're talking about wide-body planes that do fly from India to the United States that are specifically designed for that purpose, that have in the past destroyed Delta's ability to service that route because with bank financing, they undercut Delta's prices and Delta had to drop the route. And you're talking about 30 more planes that the bank is going to finance for Air India. Financing that the bank admits Air India could not have gotten otherwise. Financing on terms that the banks did not dispute would give Air India an advantage. The district court found in establishing our standing that we were going to be hurt, that there was a substantial, significant possibility that we were going to have adverse effects from these planes, and now they're saying they can categorically exclude that, and that is not consistent with the statute. The bank itself
admits...
Of course,
down the road, obviously, if you were to prevail in this case, the bank would be required to consider the effects, and consideration of the effects doesn't guarantee you much.
Absolutely correct. It does not guarantee us a result. We actually believe that if the bank actually looks at this, looks at the potential benefits to Boeing from these versus the harms to U.S. airlines, it will not be able to conclude that there are no serious adverse effects. It will not be able to conclude. But we're not saying that the bank had to come to a particular outcome. We are saying that Congress required them to consider these factors in making this decision. Now, the bank's position is we don't have to look to see whether this loan is going to, on balance, help or hurt U.S. industry. We don't even have to consider
isn't that because they read B-1B as their interpretation of B-1B is colored by the clear language of the other two provisions that talk about goods and commodities. You know, what is unreasonable about that sort of interpretation? Because that's what we're at least at Skidmore deference, right?
That.
And so is there something unreasonable about...
Well, first of all, there's nothing to defer to. As I've said, the only analysis of the statute provided by the bank itself was back in 1979. Now, they can't provide an analysis on appellate review and ask for deference to that. In 79, they interpreted these provisions as requiring an analysis in every single instance. Its intervener has argued that 631B1B should be interpreted in that light, but the bank itself has not done so, and there's nothing to defer to. But let me walk through the three statutes, if I might. B1B says, take into account any serious adverse effect. Now, then it goes on, it says, let's give particular emphasis to the objective of strengthening the competitive position of United States exporters and therefore of expanding total United States exports. Airline seats are the equivalent of an export. There is no analysis by the bank suggesting otherwise. The term export is used elsewhere in the statute to include both goods and services, so there's no reason that it would be limited to goods. And in any event, the particular provision just says give particular emphasis. So even if you read it that way, that exports only applies to goods, it says particular emphasis, not exclusive emphasis. And I would suggest that the reference to expanding total U.S. imports means look at the whole picture, balance these two provisions. And that's what the bank acknowledges at page 47 of its brief. Now let's go on and look at 635A, where it says ensure that full consideration is given to the likely adverse effect of any financial guarantee. And then it goes on, it says, either by reducing demand for goods produced in the United States, okay, so you can say goods aren't airline seats because they're a service, right, or by increasing imports to the United States. Again, there's an or there. And presumably the second clause is there because it means something different than the first clause. And again, the term imports is used in the statute and other places to refer expressly to both goods and services. So again, there's no textual hook there that would allow them to read into 635B1 that kind of limitation. And then you go to 635E. May not extend a financial guarantee that will cause substantial industry. And there it talks about commodities for export. Now, I would note that in the bank's new procedures, which they just recently adopted, they treat airline seats as commodities under this statute. That's what their new regulations do. So, and there's a good reason for that. Commodities can refer to whether you're renting or buying a DVD or downloading a movie or renting it on demand. It's the same commodity. And here we're talking about airline seats, which are the same commodity. In any event, the bank has not offered any analysis contrary to that reading of the statute.
Even if we disagree with you on the commodity point, that doesn't affect your point about the imports and exports language and the other.
That's correct. Even if you disagree with me on that, it does not. And I can understand the desire to interpret all three provisions in one way, but to do so in a way that categorically excludes over 90% of the bank's transactions from any economic analysis is clearly contrary to congressional intent, particularly when you look at the legislative history of 635B1B, where the Senate expressly said the reason they're putting this in there is they're concerned about airline sales. I'll read you from the Senate report, which is quoted at page 7 of our brief. It says the financing, since Congress was specifically concerned about, quote, the financing of aircraft purchases by foreign airlines which are in direct competition with U.S. air carriers. It's the whole point of Congress's directive to the bank to look at the whole picture, to balance the considerations and decide, is this going to help or is this going to hurt? And in this case, it's undisputed that it's going to be devastatingly hurtful to U.S. airlines trying to fly international routes in competition with the latest, greatest subsidized aircraft supported by the Export-Import Bank.
Let me ask you this. You may be right on the law, but how do we unscramble this global egg, particularly, and why should we, particularly when it's not going to happen again with the new, at least they won't be stopped at stage one. They will have to, in fact, look at the adverse economic effects.
And first of all, I didn't mean to suggest that the new regulations are a panacea. They are not. We are challenging them. The bank has still acknowledged that even under their new regulations, they're going to exclude 90% of transactions from analysis. So we've filed a separate challenge.
Well, they have to consider rules. It, though. I mean, your argument is they don't even have to.
They still use an exportable goods screen, even though they've acknowledged that airline seats are a commodity.
Do we know how many of these 30 planes have been built or where the loan and guarantees?
Six have been delivered out of 30. Six. I recognize it might be difficult to unscramble the loan guarantees that have already been made. We sought a stay in the district court or preliminary injunction, and it was denied, and we didn't appeal that. But there's still 24 to go. And those 24, the court should vacate the Ex-Im Bank's decision here to give those. The district court on remand can work out the details of the remedy. We're not asking that those six planes be pulled off the tarmac and sent back, although I would note in the government contract context, government contracts are often overturned after the fact, and there's a lot of unscrambling of eggs that has to be done. Well, but there's still 24 planes here.
All right, but the 24 planes, where do we know from the record where the financing is at this point? I mean, has that been completed? Has the bank...
The guarantees are not given until the plane... It's a closing at which the guarantees are given, the planes are delivered, the planes are turned over, the financing is provided all at once. So guarantees have only been actually given.
Boeing isn't going to build a 787 without knowing that the bank's going to either loan or guarantee it.
It is. Boeing actually has a huge backlog of 787s with lots of customers ready to take them. So they're building them as fast as they can. And they're trying to put them into service, notwithstanding some issues that have arisen with them.
Right.
But that does not excuse the bank from not doing what the statute requires. Indeed, the fact that there's a long lead time
I know that.
Underscores.
I'm just saying that if we are at the stage where, with these 24 planes, everything's been signed, the money's gone from here to there, and suddenly we come in with an opinion that says, the bank had no authority to do this?
Well, the bank did have no authority to do this. The 24 planes have not been signed, sealed, and delivered. The loan guarantees have not been made. The planes are still, that it is in the record that the loan, that only six planes, well, I'm not even sure that's in the record because several more planes have been delivered. But there's now a total of six planes that have been delivered. So there's 24 planes still to go.
What about the argument that the whole idea of this bank was to have streamlined procedures, and this is going to, picking up on Judge Henderson's questions and something that's in the briefs, this is really going to cause massive tumult?
You know, they could complain to Congress if they think that Congress has imposed restrictions on their freedom of movement. They want to pretend that they're a commercial bank, and they don't want to be encumbered by procedures or judicial review, but they're an agency of the United States. They, in giving guarantees, commit the full faith and credit of the United States, and Congress chose to impose specific mandatory requirements on them, not only about loan guarantees, but about environmental issues, about shipping requirements, about other things. Congress imposed those restrictions, and they can't point to anything in the statute that suggests that they're exempt from judicial review. Quite the contrary, there are a couple of provisions that exempt them from notice and comment rulemaking under Section 5, but there's nothing to exempt them under Section 7. And under this court's precedence, shall, must constitutes law to apply, and therefore is not completely committed to their discretion. Their discretion is cabined by what Congress has provided. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Stern.
May it please the court, I'd like to just very briefly sort of say something about the overview, but then I'd like to talk about the specific statutory provisions that were discussed by my colleague, Mr. Kellogg, and the Mr. Kellogg, sort of in closing, noted that these loan preliminary loan guarantees and loan guarantees are relied on by the world and backed by the full faith and credit of the United States. They are relied on from the moment that they issue these loan guarantees. There was a final loan guarantee and preliminary loan guarantees for Air India. They issued in 2006. They were subject to congressional review. Congress had no objection. We're talking about a long history of reliance on these guarantees. And if plaintiff is quite clear, their whole basis for standing in this case is that it's only these loan guarantees that are making this transaction possible. That's their theory of standing in this case. And the other thing that they've emphasized in their district court filing, I don't have the site right now, but it's in the joint appendix. It's a statement from Delta's vice president that says, if there's uncertainty about financing at the point where planes are supposed to be delivered, this would have an enormously disruptive effect.
I'm not sure the significance of this. Because it would cause a lot of problems, we should just pack our bags?
Well, I think...
Don't we still have to look at the statutory issue? I know you have been...
Absolutely, Your Honor. I just want to make clear
that
there's a framework, but the consequences are significant in figuring out the overall structure of what we've
got. So this goes to a no law to apply argument, right?
It's part of it,
You cite a 1960 case, and your no law to apply argument was a severe stretch.
I'll tell you, I think that the reason that we don't have any more cases that are more closely on point than that one is that the bank has been around in one form or another since the 1930s, and it's been operating under the present statute since, I think, the late 40s. There have been no attempts by disappointed loan applicants, much less by third parties, to come and seek judicial review. When scrambling around to find the closest analog, this is the best I could come up with. And I agree, it's a 1960 case. But what it does do...
There's language in this statute that sets forth standards, and well, as you know better than anyone, we have lots of cases with similar language that we review.
Absolutely, but we're not relying... I'd like to come back to language, but we're not relying exclusively on the language. What Congress has said again and again, and so has and all the critics of the bank, have said, you've got to move fast. This is the, if you read through all the legislative history, all the problems that we, you know, where people are raising is, this bank is in competition with the export credit agencies of other countries. So, for example, if there's a competition to get a big airline contract, it's not like there's no...
Just on the move fast, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but how is that inconsistent with doing what they ask for, which is just considering the adverse impact?
Well, let me say that,
that doesn't take much time.
No, you're right, Your Honor, but of course it's how you consider it. We've never said that we don't consider it. That's plaintiff's categorization. And the legislative history of 12 U.S.C. 635A2 on
the exportable goods screen excludes service.
No, yes, but that doesn't mean that the bank hasn't considered it. And what Congress says...
You've considered it in the sense you've created a categorical rule, but you're not going to consider it.
Well, no, that's right in one sense, but it's based on the... And I would like to just read this legislative history from the 1986 Senate report, which is where it's talking about where it added on the requirement that in some cases the bank respond in writing to concerns of importers or exporters. And it goes, the bill does not require the bank to conduct further analysis if it views its existing body of knowledge as sufficient, and it says that it wants the bank to implicate the adverse economic impact analysis procedures in a practical and workable fashion. Now, most of these loans have to be approved within 60 days. What the bank has always understood, and this is set out in the declarations of Mr. Cruz and Mr. Morin, is that there is a difference between services and exportable goods. It's not that the bank doesn't care about the impact on the economy generally or the impact on Delta in particular, but the focus of the kind of harm that sort of is measurable and that's been of the biggest concern throughout.
What's the statutory basis for the bank taking that view, that they don't need to look at services, that this is all about?
Well, again, it's not that we don't need to look at services. But that's a very important point, Your Honor.
I guess another way of phrasing it or looking at this case is, what's the reasonableness of the...
Well, that's what's set out in part in... I mean, I'd like to make clear the... By the way, I just want to clarify that the reference, that the suggestion the bank has ever changed its procedures on this, and this is some great departure, Mr. Kellogg quoted from 1141 of the Joint Appendix, in that also, that at that point it also says that it also specifically points out that not every case will necessitate a full discussion of the questions, which is what the bank's point is. And the bank is very conversant with the airline industry in particular. It's operated with the Air Transport Association in the international arena in working with the export credit agencies of other countries to ensure that the airline industry in the United States is going to be competing on a level playing field, and that trying to establish the kind of best terms that can be offered by the bank's competitors abroad. The bank takes into account the impact of its loans and in the broader context of the international situation, not simply sort of in doing a sort of calculus on, sort of revisiting a calculus on each specific case. Now, the...
Right. I think we are, and they agree you can do some categorical rules here. It just seems like this one isn't rooted in something that makes sense given the overall language of the statute.
Well,
Yeah, that's at least the concern. I was thinking of analogies like a statute that says sentencing court must consider the potential for rehabilitation, and a judge says, well, in drug cases, I'm just going to categorically not consider that because I don't think they have potential for rehabilitation. You know, that's the kind of, I don't,
well,
think
it
we wouldn't go for that, and I'm trying to figure out why this case is different.
Because it's a decision about the likely impact of a kind of funding, you're funding a contract that is going to result in enormous investment in the United States, creating United States jobs, which
right.
is the key point. So then, in looking,
you also have to consider the other U.S. industries affected.
Well,
it seems just consider.
We might go back
in circles on what consider means.
Well, no, but I think that is in fact crucial, because the question is the bank violating some statutory limitation by saying, look, I've looked at where services generally fit into this. Like, we know that in particular, and this is what E7 is, like, designed to 635 E7 is designed to deal with, that there are particular concerns that are raised. For example, if you fund enterprises abroad that will produce goods that then can be exported and go into competition. And there are means, and as the Cruz Declaration explains, there are means for, like, easily assessing the kinds of competitiveness that can occur there.
Would you say in this case that the bank considered the impact on U.S. service providers?
I think that the bank did, in the sense that it's operating, that it, and this is its history with the airline industry. It's the bank as well as services generally. Services, the impact on services has never been, like, the big concern in assessing, like, which is, after all, like, the language, you know, of 635B is the, among a whole slew of other things that the statute says it is the policy of the United States to consider, says you consider employment.
That's why if you just give a college try at it, it's probably not going to get overturned ever.
No, but I think that the question is, what is it
categorically?
But if, look, in district court, the plaintiff's position was you need to conduct a detailed economic analysis in every case. That would gut, like, the ability of the bank to operate with anything like the speed that it needs to. So then the question becomes, what is it the plaintiffs say we need to do? So their answer is, we need to do something. We go, we are doing something. We have screens. The screens are revisited. They reflect the judgment and experience of the bank. We explain that in the declarations. Plaintiffs say, well, you shouldn't look at the declarations. And go, well, first of all, under Camphy Pitts, of course you would look at the declarations. But it also gets matters entirely backwards, because the bank isn't a regulatory agency in the same way it is an agency. It is not a regulatory agency.
Okay. What difference does that make?
I think it makes a huge difference, because even though Mr. Kellogg says, well, you're sort of pretending that you're a bank.
Lots of agencies do lots of important things that have to be done quickly. I don't see how we can get a bank special rule here.
I think that the bank is not regulating transactions between third parties, and this isn't even somebody coming to the bank and saying, I have an entitlement under a federal scheme, sort of in the typical way that, you know, you would have, like, a veteran sort of, like, guarantee of a home loan. Veteran sort of says, look, here are the standards, you didn't give it to me, I can seek review.
As I understand Mr. Kellogg's argument, I hope I'm not misstating it here, what I was asking about B1B, the fact that B1B doesn't talk about goods or commodities, I think the point that I made, is it unreasonable to construe B1B in light of the other two provisions that do talk about goods and commodities? And I believe his point was that that's not an argument that you all have made, that you have not pressed the argument before, till your brief perhaps, that the three should be read together.
Well, we do think, I think the Cruz Declaration specifically says the three should be read together, but that our point about it is not that the bank, in when it's looking at the broad, like, you know, it's 635B says that in authorizing it shall take into account any serious adverse effect of such loan on the competitive position of the United States industry, availability of materials and employment, giving special particular emphasis to the objective of strengthening the competitive.
And if that was the only provision we had,
right, but
it probably would not be reasonable for you to exclude a more detailed look at services, but that's not the only provision we have, right? And so is it my understanding the bank's argument is that we need to read B1B in light of A2 and E, or am I misunderstanding that?
Well, no, I think that you do, but I think that on its face, this provision doesn't provide any basis for saying that the bank in improving this loan.
So you're saying if all we had was B1B, the right. current regime would be adequate?
I think that clearly that that's adequate. There is no serious argument that's being offered by plaintiffs in their brief that 635E, the provision on limitation of assistance on commodities, mm-hmm. applies. And the provision and 635A2, which simply says that you're supposed to promulgate procedures for considering adverse impact, that's all that adds to it, and that's the provision that has the legislative history that I read earlier that specifically says that the bank can rely on its knowledge and doesn't have to go through a specific discussion in every case. And that's the way the bank has interpreted that provision from the outset. So those are the three provisions that are here. We've got one very, very broad provision, the 635B, which doesn't say anything that I think is particularly helpful. We've got another one about enacting procedures and another one about limitation on assistance, and that's about commodities, and that's in
that commodity one, just to nail this down, was enacted well after the other two, right?
So it was enacted in 86, and there was also the amendment, and 635A2 was also amended in 86.
First two weren't limited to goods when they were passed. To suddenly limit them to goods.
Oh, no. We're not arguing that.
Okay.
It's only that was a provision, just to be clear, that's the provision that has the detailed economic analysis in it, and that's what plaintiffs were relying on heavily in district court. There's sort of a bit of a moving target here. So our point is, like, when you look at this, all we have and what they're really relying on appeal is the language of 635B. We don't think that there is any way that language can be construed to say that the way that the bank has approached used its screens and approved loans sort of since 1978 onwards, like, is sort of outside of its discretion, even assuming that this is reviewable. And we continue to think there are very serious problems about the idea that you could have APA actions in the context of a bank transactions that frequently are supposed to take place from start to finish within 60 days.
Is there anything in the legislative history that indicates that Congress did not intend judicial review?
Well, so Mr. Kellogg and I take diametrically opposite views of the two references to eliminating the APA, and plaintiff's view that the two specifics suggest that there was supposed to be broad review. It's our view that what Congress did, there are two places where Congress enacted something that you might have thought was supposed to be subject to APA procedural requirements and then judicial review. And when Congress did those two things both times in 1986, with regard to each of those two provisions, it explicitly said this doesn't make the APA applicable. And then plaintiffs point out they're referring to the procedure section, not to the judicial review section, and would note that the legislative history also makes clear Congress specifically says in the Senate report in 1986 at page 9, it's that the committee does not intend to give any party the right of judicial review with regard to the requirements of this provision. That's the sort of where they sort of bulk up the adverse impact provision of 635A2 to say in certain cases you should like respond in writing to the concerns of importers and exporters. And when Congress did that, and that's something that might look like maybe here we've done something that would implicate the APA, they specifically said in the statute doesn't cover the procedures. The legislative history says, like, and we don't intend to give anybody a right of judicial review either. We think that that's the one kind of place where you might have thought that there would be judicial review. The rest of it, you know, the broad policy statements of the Charter that don't that only refer in general to the competitive impact on United States industry, I mean, of course that's what the bank was taking into account. I mean, that's what this is all about. And it's, and the bank has plenty of experience with the airlines. We look, you know, we sort of lay out there like the history of looking at airline complaints when they occurred back in the 80s with Pan Am, TWA, the 2000, I'm really having trouble moving into the century, the 2011 Delta complaint about Ryanair, where it looked, where the bank looked at it again. The bank sort of deals all the time with the aircraft with the airline industry. It understands that. It's in light of that, and some of the concerns that have been raised post 2008, because this is where sort of the ball game changes. Prior to 2008, what the airlines had always, the domestic airlines had always been able to obtain financing on better terms than anything the bank was offering, and that's what the bank sort of had repeatedly found. After 2008, when credit tightens up, and as we've noted in our brief, since then, like the amount of transactions that have been financed both by the Ex-Im Bank and by export credit agencies abroad have essentially doubled since then, to sort of step into that credit gap. And the current screens that have been adopted by the bank sort of reflect sort of not that there's some necessarily ongoing impact on the, in any case, on the airline industry, but reflect that there has been a shift in the market since the time that these original preliminary loan guarantees, approvals rather, were issued back in 2006. But that's what the bank sort of, as a banker involved in international fora and ongoing dealings, considers. And what it doesn't do is every time in each of its 4,000 like approvals every year of a loan transaction, it doesn't spell out, by the way, I really think about this stuff, like I really know what I'm doing, I'm not sort of dissing like services, I've taken that into account as part of my general like obligation under 630, under 12 USC 635B.
Okay, you're way over your time, but I do have one question. Do you agree with Mr. Kellogg that only six of these 30 planes have been delivered?
Yes, that's my understanding.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Thank you. I'm very generous with your time.
Okay. Is Mr. Kellogg? All right, why don't you take 2 minutes?
Thank you. Several quick points. The delivery schedule is not in the record, in part because the bank has never made a mootness argument. The bank has never suggested that the court should stay its hand because it cannot grant effective relief here. Mr. Stern relies on the preamble saying it's the policy of the United States. I would point out that the same preamble was at issue in Overton Park in the provision that the court, the Supreme Court said, you know, there's mandatory law there and it has to be applied. He mistakenly indicated that the bank has never been subject to judicial review. That is not correct. There's the Friends of the Earth case that we cited out in California. We cited it at page 16 of our brief. The thrust of his argument is we know what we're doing and you should trust us. Of course, we take all this stuff into account. We don't have to write it down. We don't have to build a record. We don't have to be bothered with all that stuff. And what he points to that is their history of analysis of the airline industry. I hope the court will go back and look at our reply brief analysis. He points to a 1975 short memo about two used airplanes. This was 26 years before the EIPs were passed. He points to a 1984 analysis that says this could really become a problem, selling airplanes. We should look at this again next year. Guess when they looked at it again? Never. Never. He points to a 2011, which is 10 years after they did, which is just a memo from somebody's file. We have no idea what it is. It's an analysis of a Ryanair transaction about the airline sector understanding rates, which are not at issue here anywhere. They're suggesting that you should trust them because they've analyzed the industry is just preposterous.
Just analytically thinking about this, you've acknowledged that they can use categorical rules of some kind to implement this. And then if once we've crossed that bridge, is it really so much an interpretation of the statute, or is it more a case here about the reasonableness of the category they've set out?
In other words, it's both.
Less a Chevron, more a State Farm, or less a statutory interpretation, more a State Farm kind of case with the reasonableness.
I would say that even if you could find an interpretation of the statute, which you can't, that's consistent with categorical rules, it would be arbitrary and capricious and unreasonable to adopt rules that the bank itself acknowledges absolutely precluded from conducting an economic analysis of all the 0.1% of their transactions.
I don't know why the numbers, you've emphasized that quite a bit. I'm not sure why that matters. It seems to me the bigger concern is what's the substance of the category rather than if it ends up with 10% or 90%, it seems less relevant to me than what's the substance of.
But let's look at this transaction here. We're talking about over $4 billion in guarantees, 30 planes to Air India, who competes directly on U.S. routes. Indeed, the bank acknowledges in their analysis that that's their main route. That's their, to North America, is their most significant routes. And they're going to use these planes on that route. We made a detailed showing below and to the bank that we were going to be hurt by that. The airline pilots are going to lose jobs. Delta is going to lose business. And they haven't challenged that finding. The district court found that in order to establish standing. They haven't challenged that finding. They haven't ever challenged our evidence.
Isn't that the theory that they're obviously operating on under is that it's outweighed by the benefits?
But they've never done an analysis of the benefits. You look at that, what they call the administrative record, and it says jobs created, zero, zero. Now, afterwards, they said, well, we didn't mean there wouldn't be any jobs. We just didn't bother to fill in the numbers there. But in fact, Boeing has
not zero. Right?
Well, but it could actually be because Boeing has a big backlog of these planes. And the fact that they won't be able to sell them to Air India doesn't mean they're not building them as fast as they can regardless. So it doesn't actually mean. We know concretely we are going to lose jobs and we are going to lose business as a result of this. And I don't see how it could possibly be reasonable under the statute for the bank to say, we don't even have to look at that. We don't even have to think about this loan, whether this loan is a good idea or a bad idea for the economy generally, for jobs generally.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.